Good morning. Good morning. Oh, there we go. It's good to see you this morning. I hope you've been encouraged this morning as I have. As Carrie mentioned at the beginning of our service, our songs were picked out by our graduating seniors in high school. Travis and I were talking about that and commented on how unusual it was that they didn't sing Shout Hallelujah in connection with graduation. Seems like the low-hanging fruit there, but that's all right. This morning, we are thinking about our students, their graduation. Tonight, we are having more of a graduation celebration where we're going to focus on them and their achievements. We really hope that you'll be a part of that at 5, and we especially want you to stay after for the reception. That's a chance for you to get to talk to them, congratulate them, and to be there. So we want to encourage you to be there tonight at 5 and then after for the reception. So many of you know that I had worked for the previous 12 years before we moved to Springfield in campus ministry, where I worked with college students. And I taught on campus. I taught a lot of freshmen. And over the 12 years, I got asked for advice quite often, usually by parents, on what to think about or what to prepare for or what to have in mind as they went to college. People would visit campus and they would find out what I did and they would like, what's some good advice that you can give us? And so here's the best advice that I can offer after 12 years of cultivating the experience of being around college students, drawing on my own experience, however long ago it might be as a college student. Here's what I would tell them. You need to be prepared that 98% of the time you will be incredibly annoyed by your roommate. That's some of the best advice that I could offer. As our high schools do a great job of preparing them for the rigors of academic life, parents do a great job of preparing their kids to handle various things that are coming their way, but nothing prepares you for the experience of living with another person that's a stranger. Unless you grew up sharing a room with someone, it's hard for you to prepare for that. I had some unusual experiences with roommates, and one day I was coming back to my dorm, and my roommate was being led away in handcuffs by the police. He had been caught stealing road signs and hiding them in our room. Thankfully, I wasn't there. I probably would have gotten dragged into it. I had another roommate who would stay up to all hours of the night playing video games. He didn't have a class the next day. He would leave the lights on, invite his buddies over, and if I complained about it, he'd be like, oh, yeah, okay, and then just keep on keeping on. Carrie told me about a roommate that she had that literally divided their room in half with a piece of tape, along the floor, up the walls, and in the ceiling, and nothing of Carrie's could cross over the line or it got thrown away. Can you believe that? Now, I have to admit that I was not always a peach of a roommate myself. My roommates complained that I talk in my sleep. But not just talk in my sleep, I would have conversations with my mom and talk in a higher register to do her voice. If that's not creepy, I don't know what is. It's challenging to live with another person. You're tired. You want to just go rest and hang out. Too bad. Your annoying roommate is there doing all the things that they do. But what is even more challenging than living with another person is to live for another person. When you become married and you have kids, you realize that suddenly I'm not just living with a roommate. I'm living with someone, with someone's, and it's not just me. I can't just make my own decisions and live my life however I want to. I have to take another person's wants and wishes into consideration. I have to live for them, not just for myself, with them. There's a big difference. And so the best advice that I think I can give to you guys this morning that are graduating, and honestly, this is advice that all of us should take, is to learn to live for Jesus. And it's advice not that I would give myself, but that Paul gives. If you have your Bibles, I want you to look at 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Paul gives this advice to the Corinthians, and it's advice that I think is the best thing for us to take forward, whether we're graduating or whether we're just going about our normal lives, is as Christians, we need to learn how to do this. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, starting in verse 14, Paul says, "For the love of Christ controls us. Because we have concluded this, that one has died for all, and therefore all have died. And he died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but live for him who for their sake died and was raised."
Paul says his hope is that we live for Jesus. So what does that mean? What does it mean to live for him? Well, I want to suggest three very simple things in concept, but difficult in practice for us to do. And you can remember them this way. If you're a fan of writing things down and taking notes, write this down. T-Lid. T-Lid. That's not some like really cool street rapper name. Kelly Epperly, you can't have that one. But it is an acronym. And the first one means, to live, I decide. To live, I decide. Paul says, the love of Christ controls us. Paul has decided that his belief in who Jesus is, in Jesus' love, that would control him. That would show up in a major way in his life. Now, when we talk about Christ's love, we don't mean the love that I have for Christ. We mean Christ's love for us. The love that he showed when he died on the cross for you and I. Now, how many of you would say, by a show of hands, that you believe in the love of Jesus? You believe that he loved us so much that he gave his life for us. I hope that everyone's raising your hand right now. Now, here's the question I think we have to ask. Do we really believe that? Do we believe it in like a gut level, rubber meets the road kind of way? Because Paul doesn't just say, I believe in the love of God. He says, the love of Christ controls me. It compels me. It owns me. It moves me. It motivates me. It drives me in everything that I do. That's what it means to be controlled by the love of Christ. Paul has decided that what he knows, what he professes to believe, will show up in his life in a real and tangible way. And so my question for me, my question for you and the students is this, do I really believe that? Do I believe the love of Jesus like I believe that not doing my homework or studying for the test will get me bad grades? Do I believe in the love of Jesus represented on the cross like I believe that if I don't go to practice and I don't show up to the game, I'll get kicked off the team or kicked off the show or out of the band? Do I believe it like that? Do I believe in the love of Christ like I believe getting a job and showing up to that job is what I need to do to keep my job? Do I believe in the love of Jesus like I believe I need money in my life to pay for things and to survive? Because we easily understand and grasp belief in those things as motivating factors for our decisions, right? We know that our belief in those things and those systems of life cause us to act and behave and prioritize in certain ways. So my question is, do we believe in the love of God like we believe in those things? Where it shows up in a tangible difference in how I choose to live my life. Do we believe in the love of God the way we believe in anything else? The second thing, and hopefully our belief leads us here, is to live, I die. If we truly believe in the love of Jesus in a way that causes us to decide differently about how we're going to live, the first thing it should do is cause us to die to self. Paul goes on to say that we are new creations. The old is gone and the new has come. What does it mean to die to self? It means that I die to my own wants and wishes and desires and I live instead for him who gave his life up for me. To die means what Jesus said when he said, for those who would follow me, they must hate their mother and father and brother and sister and even their own life. And unless you can do that, it's impossible to you to follow me. Now, this isn't license, of course, to be disrespectful to our parents or to hate them or to hate our brothers and sisters. What Jesus is getting at is there should be nothing in our lives that takes a priority over following him. So, to live for him means to live, I decide. I decide that my belief is going to mean something. It's going to matter in a meaningful way. And I believe to live for him means I die to self. And then the third one is, to live, I devote. If I'm dying to myself, it means that something else takes the place. And so to live for him, I devote to caring about the things that he cares about. Paul says in this passage that God has given to us the ministry of reconciliation. We are his ambassadors. We devote ourselves to caring about the things that he cares about, to doing the kinds of things that he wants us to do, to being who he wants us to be. So ultimately, to live for him means we live the life that he no longer gets to live because he gave it up for me. I'm not in the driver's seat. I'm not the one making the choices and the priorities. He is. I'm living my life as he would. Now, I want to share another story with you. If you have your Bible, of course, hopefully you do, turn over to Matthew chapter 14. This is a story that is incredibly familiar to all of us, but I want us to think about it as sort of a summation of what it's like trying to live for him, trying to decide that our belief in his love is going to matter, it's going to mean something. It's a summation of what it means to die to self and to devote ourselves to being like Jesus, and how difficult that can be. Because in concept, we can raise our hand and we can say, yeah, this is who I am and this is what I want. But to actually live that life can be very challenging. So in this story, we see Jesus doing something rather incredible. He's already done many things that were incredible. In fact, he has just taken a small amount and turned it into much, feeding 5,000 plus people. So after this, after Jesus has fed this many, he's talked with them, he's healed, he's taught, he's tired. He's wore out, and so here's what he does. He sends his disciples. He gives them a mission. I want you to get into the boat, and I want you to go to the other side. And then Jesus goes up onto a mountain to pray. After he dismissed the crowd in verse 23 of chapter 14, he went by himself on the mountain to pray, and when evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way away from the land, being beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. Now, if you have a note about the long way away, it might say that that's about 607 feet, close to 2 football fields away. But it says many away, many stadia away. They were well on their way. They were well on this journey that Jesus had sent them on together. He had sent them to the other side together. And they're way out there, and it's hard going, but they're mostly okay, right? They're fishermen. They know the deal. They know the drill. They're out there and the waves are crashing and the wind is against them, but they're still going in the direction Jesus wanted them to go. Now, about 3 a.m., the fourth watch of the night, Jesus came to them walking on the sea. Have you ever just stopped and marveled at that? I know we hear this all the time, right? Jesus walking on the sea, doing something miraculous, something incredible. And then the disciples, obviously and naturally, become afraid because they left Jesus on the shore. They know where he was. They're going where he wants them to go, thinking that he'll meet them there. And now all of a sudden they look out and they see someone walking on the sea. And of course they begin to be afraid. And then Jesus calls out and reassures them. He says, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And this is where the story begins to get even more interesting. As though Jesus walking on the water isn't enough, Peter says, "Lord, if it is you, tell me to come to you and I will." And so Jesus says, "Come." And then Peter gets out of the boat and begins to walk on the water as well. His decision to have the love of God mean something to him gets him out of the boat. He's dying to his own knowledge of how the world works. He is devoting himself to being just like Jesus. And what is it he's doing? Jesus is walking on the water. So Peter gets out of the boat and he begins to walk on the water. And then, of course, what happens? As he's walking, he watches the waves and he sees the wind and feels the spray. You know, in the ancient world, the idea of the sea was like chaos. And so the chaos is beginning to build and build around him, and he takes his eyes off of Jesus and starts to sink. And then Jesus reaches out and takes his hand and lifts him back up to solid ground, back up to solid footing, back up to this miraculous, incredible walk that defies all odds. And he says this, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" I want to pause for a second and think about what this is all about. Isn't this how life is sometimes? Where we're out and we're going
and we're mostly okay. Things are a little bit rocky. Things seemed a little bit to be against us, but we're mostly doing all right. We have some moments that are afraid, that are fearful, that Jesus tries to encourage us. And then we're out there, we're trying to follow him, we're trying to follow his example, we're trying to do what he is doing, and then the chaos of life interferes, it intervenes, it gets in our way, it gets in our face, and we take our eyes off of him. And when we do that, when we begin to see and remember how the world says we ought to live and how it says we ought to think about our surroundings, and we take our eyes off of Jesus, we begin to sink. But Jesus is there to lift us back up. Now, this is amazing to me because I wonder about this word doubt. Jesus says, why did you doubt? What is he talking about? Is this real doubt? The Greek word here suggests more the idea of vacillating between one thing and another, right? Where I'm over here and I'm like, oh, sometimes green beans are really bad, but sometimes, you know, green beans are okay if they're cooked right. Sometimes broccoli is really bad, and then sometimes broccoli is the worst thing ever, right? I mean, we can all agree on that, maybe, or maybe it's just me. But that's the idea. It's not full doubt. It is back and forth. Can't quite decide. Can't quite commit. Sometimes I'm here, and sometimes I'm here. Jesus says, in sense, why did you take your eyes off of me? Oh, you of little faith. Why did you allow everything else to distract you from what I have called you to do? And he raises him back up and he puts him on solid ground. Well, here's a question that I have. Sometimes I wonder if there wasn't two versions of this story that could play out. In one story, Jesus never gets to the phrase, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And to me, that version happens when Peter stays in the boat. As I've thought about why Jesus said, "You have little faith, why did you doubt?" I often always apply it only to Peter as he's walking on the water. But what did Jesus ask them to do? He asked them in community to go across to the other side. And then when he comes walking on the water and they're afraid, Jesus says, "It's okay. I'm with you. Take heart. Don't be afraid." Peter's first step of doubt was to put him to the test. Give me a sign. Tell me to come to you and I will. Real faith would have said, okay, I believe that you are with me. I hear you. I see you. I know that I'm safe. I will continue the course. And so I think we have two different things that are going on. Jesus is referencing not only Peter's taking his eyes off of him, but he's also, I think, thinking about, why didn't you believe me when I said, it's going to be okay. Take heart. It is I. I think this is what it's like when we try to live for him. We live for him and things get rocky. Things get difficult. Things are challenging. We take our eyes off of him. We get out of the boat that we're supposed to be in, going where we're supposed to have gone all along. But the amazing part of this story, the encouraging part of this story, happens in the blink of an eye, in a blink and you'll miss it. After Jesus reaches out and he puts him back on the water, it just simply says, and then when they had gotten back to the boat, the winds ceased. It didn't matter that Peter doubted. It didn't matter that he took his eyes off of Jesus. What mattered was that he put his eyes back on Jesus. And he was right there waiting. And then he walked until Peter was back where he was supposed to have been. Letting his love mean something. Staying the course that Jesus set him on to begin with. That's what living for him is all about. And when Jesus got him back to where he was supposed to be to begin with, the waves ceased and it said they were all amazed and they said, surely this is the Son of God. This morning, my encouragement to you, graduates, is this. Live for him. Decide that your belief in the love of Christ is going to mean something in a powerful, tangible way. Decide that you will die to yourself to live for him and devote yourself to the things that he cares about. The next 4 years of your life are not an opportunity to just push pause and do whatever you want. The next 4 years of your life are an opportunity to become a better version of who you are for him. The next 4 years, like anything else, aren't yours to spend. They're his. To the rest of us, I would say, yeah, pretty much the same thing. Our lives are not our own. Let us live for him. Let us either stay in the boat, or if we find ourselves walking on the water, let us keep our eyes firmly fixed upon him. Let us allow ourselves and our belief, our professed belief in the love of God, mean something in a powerful way. It could be this morning that you are here and you have yet to get into the boat. You have yet to make that commitment. You've yet to decide that you are going to die to yourself and devote to him. We want to help you with that. We want to help you put Christ on in baptism so you can begin your journey. Or it could be that you have found yourself called out on the water and you're sinking. It is hard with the difficulties and the pain of life to keep your eyes fixed on him. We want you to know that we want to be the hand reaching out to lift you back up onto this miraculous footing that can be ours when we walk with Christ. If there's anything that we can help you with this morning, please come as we stand and sing our final song.